From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.
The yeas are 220. The nays are 213. The Build Back Better bill is passed.
There were cheers from Democrats and silence from Republicans this morning as President Biden's big social spending and climate change bill passed in the House. But it sure was a bumpy ride. Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy delayed the vote with an 8.5-hour stem winder, slamming the Democrats' expansive agenda. When he finally gave up talking at about 5 o'clock this morning, it was Nancy Pelosi's turn. The House Speaker joked that her remarks would be brief.
Following the vision of President Biden, guided by the expertise and energy of our chairs, members, and staff, we have built back better bill that is historic, transformative, and larger than anything we have ever done before.
And now this bill faces a treacherous Senate, which brings us to our Friday Politics Roundtable. Scott Wong covers House leadership for The Hill and has a nice name like somebody I know. Hi, Scott.
How you doing? Thanks.
I'm great. And Francesca Chambers covers the White House for McClatchy. Francesca, good to have you.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. To the spending bill. Total of nearly $2 trillion, that will be for paid family leave, expanded child care, expanded Medicare, subsidies for green cars. It got zero Republican votes. Here's Florida GOP House member Kat Kamick.
As the member designated by Mr. Loudermilk of the state of Georgia, I inform the House that Mr. Loudermilk will vote hell no on H.R. 5376, a.k.a. Build Back Broke, and good luck in the Senate. And with that, I yield back.
Scott, those are the Republicans. As far as the Democrats in the House, some of them were worried about the price tag of this and potentially stoking inflation. In the end, what brought them on board?
Well, this bill is chock full of priorities that they had promised voters and that President Biden had promised voters from their campaign in 2020. And in their mind, they have delivered, albeit, you know, it now faces a difficult road in the Senate, as you pointed out. Mm-hmm. But this is focused on, you know, things like universal preschool, funding for child care, elder care, extending child tax credits, climate initiatives, the list goes on and on. And it really is a remarkable feat for the House Democrats to get all of these 220 members on the same page, marching in the same direction. We saw this fight play out between the warring moderate and progressive factions for months and months. It was ugly. Mm-hmm. The sausage making is not pretty. But in the end, yeah, Nancy Pelosi was able to rally her troops and get it through the House.
Now, they were watching closely for how this would be scored, which I guess is beltway speak for, you know, the official numbers as far as whether it would add to the deficit. That came late yesterday. Was that an important piece of all this, Scott?
Yeah, it was. In fact, moderates had been withholding their votes, a handful of moderates, and essentially blocking the bill until that CBO score came out. What it showed was that it will add to the deficit by more than $300 billion over the decade, but it doesn't account for key IRS provisions. Basically, they're bulking up the IRS, and the White House has argued that when you factor in the IRS provisions with tougher enforcement for those tax collectors, it actually will cut the deficit. So that's an argument that a lot of moderates actually are buying. And I think that helped a lot of those moderates get on board with the steep spending price of this bill.
All right. Now, Francesca, this bill now heads to the Scylla and the Charybdis of the Senate, where there's no guarantee. What might the Democrats have to add or subtract to try to get the votes they need?
Well, things that they could have to subtract would be paid family and medical leave that's in the House version 4 weeks. That's something that is likely to be cut in the Senate in order to get the vote of Senator Joe Manchin. Another thing with regards to the state and local tax deduction, the House would like to lift that cap up to $80,000 from $10,000. And in the Senate, that is something that senators, including Bernie Sanders, have said that they just can't get behind. They do not want to have a wealthy giveaway. But there could be a middle ground on that that would satisfy both those moderate House members and it would satisfy some of the more progressive senators. Because the key thing here is that if the Senate changes anything, and we expect they'll change several things, that even once they pass it, it'd have to pass again in the House. And then in the Senate, they have to pass the same version of that before we'd even see it get to President Biden's desk for his signature.
So far from over. Let's go back just for a moment here to Kevin McCarthy and his marathon speech last night. Let's listen to some of it. Here's how he started.
Let me be clear. Never in American history has so much been spent at one time.
Here he is about halfway through, 4 hours later.
If America asked me what went wrong, one party rule for one term.
And then at about 5 a.m, he wrapped up.
This is a tipping point. This is a point of not coming back from.
So, Francesca, quite a display of, speaking there for many hours. Before this happened, I didn't even know the House had its own kind of filibuster, or what they call it, a magic minute, I guess it's called in the House. What do you think Kevin McCarthy was trying to achieve with that speech?
Well, just prior to this, I was speaking to a senior GOP aide who indicated that while part of the intention was to delay the vote and slow it down, that more of the intent was to tell the American people about what's inside of it, because they are looking at polling that to them suggests that if Americans knew what these provisions are and what they did, that they might not be as supportive. Of course, advocates in favor of the bill, Democrats, think that the more that they tell people what's in the bill, that Americans will support it. But Republicans think that by spending all of that time explaining all of these provisions that Americans might not know were in there would be helpful. So less about the fact that it would keep it from being passed, it eventually was, and more about using their time to try and go on the record about some of these provisions that they're against.
Scott, sticking with Republicans, let's talk for a moment about Paul Gosar. This is the Republican House member from Arizona, censured by the House this week for tweeting out an anime video, a doctored anime video, showing him killing Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. As a result of this vote, he lost committee assignments. He was unrepentant publicly, by the way. What do you make of this punishment, given that it really could be all reversed if Republicans just take back the House in the next election?
Well, that's right. Democrats were waiting for Republicans to act to punish Gosar for what I think almost all of us believe is pretty, pretty disgusting stuff. And Republicans stood by Gosar, including Kevin McCarthy, saying, look, he took the video down. He said it wasn't his intent to promote violence, and we take him at his word. Well, that wasn't good enough for the Democrats, and they quickly reacted and stripped him of his committee assignments and also censured him, making him the first lawmaker in more than 10 years since Charlie Rangel to be censured on the House floor. But McCarthy at a press conference said that if and when Republicans take back power in 2022, he will put both Gosar and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was also stripped of her committee assignments earlier this year, back on committees and said they have a right to serve. And so, under Republican rule, there really would be no sort of consequences. It's interesting because Republicans in recent years have been targets themselves of political violence. Think back to Steve Scalise almost losing his life in that mass shooting at a congressional baseball practice in 2017.
Mm-hmm. Francesca, let's talk about another House member. This week, the Wyoming Republican Party voted to stop recognizing Congresswoman Liz Cheney as a Republican, seeking to boot her out of the party in the state because of her criticism of former President Trump. Mind you, she is one of the most conservative members of the House. What is this telling us about either the state of Wyoming or the broader Republican Party now?
Well, when you look at the broader Republican Party, you also have Illinois Rep. Adam Kinzinger, who is not going to be running for re-election, and that is more based on redistricting in his state and how that was going to come down. But the point being that they have been two of the most, if not the most, vocal Republicans on Capitol Hill against the former president. And they both voted for impeachment as well the second time around. And so when you look at that, you have one that's leaving that would leave her currently as the sole Republican who speaking of the Gozar vote, voted for censure as well, left standing on Capitol Hill. And that really tells you something about where the Republican Party is and where it could potentially be going in the next Congress.
Okay. And quick minute, a quick topic. This morning, the president went for his first annual physical in office. Francesca, I understand this was a bit of a surprise to reporters. Why?
Well, the White House issued guidance this morning that the president would be undergoing this. But importantly, what was surprising about it is that because he had a colonoscopy, that he transferred power to Vice President Kamala Harris for more than an hour, making her technically the first woman president in American history. So making history today.
History was made indeed. Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for McClatchy, and Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now that the infrastructure bill is law, states are eager to get their hands on money to fix roads, bridges, and expand broadband. These projects are expected to create 1 million new jobs over the next decade. But where will the construction workers come from? For months now, we've been talking about a labor crisis that's touched nearly every sector of the U.S. economy. Let's bring in Joe Kane. He's a fellow at Brookings Metro who focuses on infrastructure. Joe, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So it's one thing to have all this money for new infrastructure, but do we have enough skilled workers to pull it off?
Yeah, that's a question. And I would argue no. I mean, this is a generational challenge that's existed for quite some time, you know, for decades, really, where there have been challenges not only filling short-term construction jobs, construction unemployment right now is under 5%, but actually in terms of long-term operation and maintenance positions. So think a lot of skilled trades type positions, plumbers, electricians, truck drivers. You know, when we actually build something out, that's just really just the beginning of the full infrastructure life cycle. So the question is, who is going to be filling these shoes for the next 10, 20, 30 plus years? And we really don't have a good answer to that.
Right. And infrastructure, it's sort of a broad term. It covers a lot of different jobs. As you mentioned, you ticked through some of them. Where do you see the biggest issue?
Yeah, I see in terms of a lot of those skilled trades type positions. So we can focus on transportation, water, energy, broadband or telecommunications. But real challenges in terms of replacement needs. There is a silver tsunami in this sector, meaning that there are many workers who are eligible or already about to retire. And so the question that's facing a lot of these infrastructure owners and operators across the country is who are going to be filling the shoes of these skilled workers who are already in place.
And those are pretty good paying jobs too, right? So, I mean, you don't have enough young people coming into those jobs, and you don't have enough women going into those jobs either. How do you open up the pipeline so that you can get them in the door, start working?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just about filling a single job on a single project at a single point in time, but about creating a long-term, durable talent pipeline. What we see in terms of the wage potential here, it's huge. I mean, these are equitable careers in that they pay up to 30% more at sort of beginning levels of careers, beginning sort of entry-level jobs. And so, you know, there isn't as much formal education required for many of these positions. You know, across all infrastructure jobs, we measure there are about 17 million workers, about one out of every 10 workers nationally employed in infrastructure right now. Half only have a high school diploma or less. So they don't need a lot of formal education. They pay, you know, earn higher wages starting out. And yet there are real challenges onboarding these workers because they require a lot more on-the-job training. They require certifications. And so that's the challenge, is a lot of unemployed and underemployed workers, including women and people of color coming out of this recession, could consider careers in this space. How are they actually going to cross that bridge into this sector? And it's not always straightforward.
So it's labor. I'm also thinking about all the raw materials you need for big infrastructure projects and the supply chain problems that we've been having. So when you put all of this together, what kind of expectations do you think we should have for how quickly contractors can start breaking ground?
Yeah, look, it's the sort of the question of the hour, so to speak, where we actually saw during the last stimulus was the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act about a decade ago. It took a little longer for some of that money to get out there. But that makes sense. Infrastructure is designed to be a generational investment. You know, as much as we have a gold rush mentality to do something very quickly and there's a clear demand, we also have to be intentional and careful in how we're investing this money. It's not infinite. And we have to hope that we can stretch the dollar as much as we can here so that when we look back in 10, 20 years, we realize, hey, we actually maximize this opportunity versus just going for the quick win and doing the same things over and over again.
Joe Kane is a fellow at Brookings Metro who focuses on infrastructure. Joe, thank you so much.
Thanks again.
And as we just heard, this problem goes a lot deeper than construction workers. It'll be truck drivers who get the shipments of lumber, concrete, and steel to those new infrastructure projects. And you guessed it, there's a shortage of truckers, too.
All right, so this student right here is doing what we call a straight back.
And it's no easy job. I spent an afternoon recently with Tim Kernstein at the Phoenix Truck Driving Institute, where a couple dozen student drivers were out in the parking lot learning the basics, like how to reverse a 70-foot tractor trailer.
The hard part is moving the trailer back straight. And if he does it correctly, he can back up for miles without ever hitting anything.
And if you think that sounds tough.
Then they also have to do a parallel park. Can you imagine parallel parking a semi-truck? And the guy's doing it right now.
Oh, he just ran over a cone.
He ran over a cone.
Oh, he hit another one.
But that's a cone only. So always tell the students that the cone represents a fire hydrant or another vehicle. So you don't ever want to hit these things.
Once that student figures out how to parallel park, he's probably going to land a job with his new commercial driver's license.
Anybody coming right out of school can make up to $50,000, $60,000 first year. And it only goes up after that.
In fact, I've heard that the shortage of drivers is so bad that some carriers are offering $100,000, six figures, to drive a truck.
That is true. With the sign-on bonuses and the guaranteed money plus the miles that you do, I've noticed a few companies just in southern Arizona that are paying upwards of over $100,000 for drivers.
The higher pay may not be enough to solve a problem that's plagued trucking for years. The work is grueling and dangerous, the hours are long, and now with ports clogged and consumer demand surging, the American Truck Driving Association says the industry is short 80,000 drivers. That's 30% higher than before the pandemic started. It's no surprise to Tim Kernstein.
Just look at the shelves when you go to the grocery store. Everything that gets delivered, anything that you buy, from a grocery store to a convenience store to a furniture store, is all delivered by a truck at some point. Just a quick example. When I first started out in this industry, I was making 36 cents a mile. Most companies these days are starting out at 50 cents or more as a brand new driver, plus the incentives. So you could tell the demand has gone up.
What are the carriers saying to you as a truck driving school? What do they need from you?
They want drivers. Period. Male, female, old, young, it doesn't matter. They want a good quality driver that's going to put the time in and make a really good wage doing it.
Are you seeing people that might never have considered truck driving as a job before, but maybe the pandemic hit and they're like, I got to do something else. I can't work in a restaurant anymore or something like that.
Yes. Just an example, beauticians, barbers, that the pandemic shut their doors and they still had to put food on the table. Bartenders, taxi drivers, they just can't make a living doing some of those things anymore because of the pandemic.
The fact is, though, it sounds like you and other schools, you're not able to really meet the demand that there is out there. Even all these incentives that the carriers are offering isn't enough. How do you solve this problem?
I tell my students a lot, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. So every student that comes through, they have that potential to be that next figure up there and be in the industry for 20, 30 years. And I've known millionaires that are just truck drivers. Their 401's got over $1 million in it. And when they're ready to retire.
This may be controversial at a truck driving school, but what about automation? Is that the solution for the future?
You know, the automations are going to come. It's not going to stop. There's a campus in Tucson that's it's called TU Simple, and it is an automated truck driving company.
It's here already.
It's here. It's not going to stop. It's going to only get better. But trucks are not going to fuel themselves. They're not going to unload themselves. There's going to be a demand for drivers for decades to come.
Financial security is part of the allure for Magdalena Garcia.
You do have to trust in yourself a lot.
Just a fraction of truck drivers are women. It's an untapped pool of workers who've traditionally avoided the industry. When Garcia lost her job during COVID, she used it as an opportunity to follow in her uncle's footsteps. She's starting a family dump truck company.
Within the last few months, we saw that the market went up here in Arizona and that houses were selling for $20,000 over asking price. And it was because of that that my mom was able to sell her house. And with that income, we are able to start the company. I'm going to be the first driver. My brother's soon to come after me, and we'll see where it goes after that.
You're sort of a coveted demographic in terms of being a woman. I mean, it's a rarity, I think, in this industry. And also, if the industry is going to go forward, I think people like Tim know that it's important to get women involved. Mm-hmm. Is this something that you were thinking about as you kind of embark upon this new stage in your life?
Yeah, so personally speaking, my uncle told me, you know, there are women in the industry. They're 65 years old. If they can drive, you can do it. You're young, you're smart, you're capable. You know, just get behind the wheel and start learning. And when I first came here, I was nervous. I was scared. And they told me, you know, as long as you don't quit, which I was like, I'm not going to quit, we will make sure that you get your license.
And she's almost there. After we spoke, Tim Kernstein and I watched as she climbed behind the wheel.
As soon as she takes the brakes, come look on both sides. You can see how nothing's touching any of the lines. Brakes are on.
And just like that, the trucker-to-be parallel parked a 70-foot trailer into an 85-foot spot. That was impressive.
Thank you.
That's got to feel like, I don't know, like an accomplishment.
I am proud of myself, yes. I'm proud of myself for being able to do it and for finally understanding it. It took a long time and a lot of questions. And
congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, good luck to you.
Thank you.
One more person with a commercial license won't solve the driver shortage, but there's no doubt Magdalena Garcia will find her way in the industry.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
The drugstore chain CVS will close about 900 stores over the next 3 years. It's part of its strategy to create a different type of store that's more focused on healthcare and consumers' ever-changing shopping habits. Let's bring in Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike.
Hi.
So for a few years, it seemed to me like new stores were popping up everywhere. Why is CVS suddenly shrinking?
Well, Peter, you know, the announcement from the company says that they have been evaluating changes in population, consumer buying patterns, and the future healthcare needs to ensure that they have the right kind of stores in the right locations. But to your point, I think it very much ties into sort of the broader strategy of CVS to not only be a pharmacy and a drugstore selling deodorant and aspirin and that type of thing, but also to actually provide healthcare services in many of its locations. So it's all part of the strategy to sort of reimagine the company as something more than just a drugstore.
And to that point, in 2019, CVS acquired the health insurance company Aetna and planned to turn the company into a healthcare destination. Is that what you're talking about here? Is there a connection?
Yeah, so there's basically three types of locations that CVS is now operating. One is the traditional drugstore and pharmacy that we're all pretty familiar with. Another one is that plus a Minute Clinic, which is basically a sort of an urgent care that's staffed by nurse practitioners and physician assistants, the type of place you might go, like an urgent care if you think you have strep throat or the flu or something like that. And then the third is what's known as a health club, which kind of builds on that Minute Clinic idea. And it's also geared towards providing care and products for chronic conditions, say diabetes or high blood pressure, even mental health issues. And it even, some locations offer things like a yoga room. And it ties back to the Aetna acquisition in that, you know, they're trying to tie these two ends of the business together, health insurance, on one end, and also sort of being able to control the cost of healthcare on the other end through these clinics and health hubs, as they call them.
And maybe controlling the experience as well. I don't know about you, but I recently went to a brand new Walgreens near my house that it looked like the Taj Mahal. It was so nice. Is there some competition happening right now in the industry to make sure that, you know, shopping at one of these stores is actually a pleasant experience?
Yeah, there absolutely is a lot of competition. Not only, drugstores and sort of the front of the store stuff, your deodorant and your Advil and that sort of thing is obviously being disrupted by online competitors. And also just from other real brick and mortar competitors, Target and Walmart and whatnot. But in general, you know, CVS is not really abandoning this idea of the drugstore. There are almost 10,000 CVS locations. So these 900 that they're closing is, you know, less than 10% of that. So more of a fine tuning than sort of a broad reshaping of their footprint.
And just real quick, Mike, CVS hasn't said which locations it will close, but some people are worried that it will close stores in underserved lower-income communities.
Yeah, they didn't really address it specifically in the announcement. The spokesperson is quoted in some coverage as saying they will take that into consideration. And I'd point out last month they actually hired what they call a chief health equity officer who is basically going to focus on things like underserved communities.
Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks very much. Have a great weekend.
You too, Peter. Thank you.
A jury in Kenosha, Wisconsin, has found 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty on all counts in killing two people and shooting another during racial unrest last summer.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty. As to the second count of the information, Richard McGinnis, we, the jury, find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty. As to the third count of the information, unknown male, we, the jury, find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty.
And joining us now is Chuck Kornbach of member station WUWM in Wisconsin, and he's in the courthouse. Chuck, I've just seen some of the courtroom video of Rittenhouse collapsing and sobbing in his chair when the not guilty verdicts were read. Were you in the courtroom? What else did you see?
Well, I was just downstairs in the media room where the cameras were on Mr. Rittenhouse, and indeed they're crying and shaking at the verdict, as others in the courtroom, from what we could see of the cameras, some were stunned, others were crying for another reason, that they were disappointed in the verdict. But yes, that was Rittenhouse's reaction, crying, I guess, tears of joy or relief.
Yeah. Now, Kyle Rittenhouse faced first-degree intentional homicide and first-degree reckless homicide, among other counts. Not guilty on all of these counts. Remind us of Rittenhouse's main defense here.
Well, he had been claiming self-defense, of course, that on the night of August 25th, 2020, he and other armed civilians gathered to protect downtown Kenosha used car lots, they said, with the permission of the owners. The owners testified otherwise. But anyway, they were here that night, and that later on in the evening, after the police had shoved protesters out of the area of the courthouse towards downtown where the armed civilians were, the interactions occurred with Joseph Rosenbaum, who Rittenhouse shot. The defense said, you know, that Rittenhouse was cornered, that he had no choice but to shoot Rosenbaum.
Yeah.
And then the incidents occurred with Anthony Huber and Gage Grosskreutz, Huber being killed, of course, Grosskreutz badly wounded in the arm.
Now, I mean, this has just happened here. Do you have any sense whether there could be a significant public reaction in Kenosha? I mean, the event in question in this trial had to do with a large gathering and racial issues.
Right. Well, Here's the thing. We were not told of a verdict was coming, but Jacob Blake's family and others, groups are called Leaders of Kenosha, announced a news conference before we were even told the verdict was coming. They said they were going to be responding to the verdict. Well, sure enough, someone must have known something, because the news conference was outside just after the verdict had read. They all had assembled before the verdict was read, and my colleague Emily Files has been out there and reports that Justin Blake, Jacob Blake's uncle, called this a tragic day for Kenosha and claiming that the judge was biased. We're going to be hearing more from the family. There's another news conference with relatives or friends of Jacob Blake responding more from the city of Kenosha, at least the Black members of it that are concerned about this verdict, it appears.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you're describing, this family is giving its version of the story. Quickly, is there any sense of what happens next procedurally, a potential appeal here?
Well, it's our understanding that the prosecution cannot appeal this. We don't know if there will be other sorts of lawsuits. There is, you know, at least one or two lawsuits from the people that were shot or their families. But in terms of what we're hearing from the prosecution, and Mr. Thomas Binger, the lead prosecutor in this case, has said he's not going to talk to the media, but our understanding is that there's not going to be much more from the district attorney's office here on this matter.
All right. Chuck Hornbach is covering the Rittenhouse trial for WUWM in Wisconsin. Chuck, thanks for talking to us quickly.
Thank you.
The first military post to welcome Afghan refugees in July ended its program on Wednesday. Fort Lee in Virginia was one of eight installations the Pentagon chose to temporarily house evacuees. But the Afghans who went to Fort Lee have now all been resettled. Still, many evacuees remain at military spots elsewhere in the country. Let's get a new update now with Krish Omara Vignaraja. She's on the front lines of this as president of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Krish, hi again, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your organization has worked closely to resettle Afghan families. For those who have found homes, how are they doing? What do they need?
Well, it's been a hopeful new beginning to a new life here. Obviously, they're trying to settle in, find affordable housing, make sure they know what's happening with their family left behind in Afghanistan. But there is so much hope alongside that anxiety. And it's been really amazing, the outpouring of support that we've seen in communities all across the country.
Have you met with some of these families? Do you have a picture of the situation that you can share with us to help us understand?
Yeah, so since August, I have met with a number of families. And they come with hope and fear. You know, I actually just met with a number of them at a job fair in Northern Virginia, where, you know, they came eager to start being contributing members here in America. But of course, they're still worried. They're asking questions about what we can do to help family that remains in harm's way with the Taliban seeking retribution in many cases. So we're trying to deal with helping them resettle and, you know, get a foothold, as we're also dealing with the worries, everything that they think about the home they left behind.
Totally understandable. Well, the last evacuees that went to Fort Lee in Virginia have left. There are still many more still in temporary military housing elsewhere in the country. What's the situation there? How many people are still awaiting homes, and can the system handle them?
Yeah, so we have tens of thousands of Afghans who are still on the military bases in the U.S. We had one military base which closed its doors to Afghan families just in this last week at Fort Lee. But obviously, there are a number of military bases across the country that are still being used. So, you know, about 25,000, a little more than that, who are here in the U.S. But we also have tens of thousands who are on lily pads abroad who are still waiting to come here to the U.S.
Mm. Now, I understand the White House announced last week that the fees for applying for work permits and green card status in the U.S. would be waived for Afghans coming to this country after July 30th. What is the process for them applying for permanent status? Are some Afghan families already moving down that track?
They are. But it's obviously a very slow process. We have been advocating that humanitarian parolees, which is how largely these individuals came into the country, that they be allowed to access special immigrant visas and the traditional refugee resettlement program. Unfortunately, that hasn't come to pass yet. And so right now they have to enter the asylum program. It's obviously incredibly backlogged, as we know, by the fact that there are more than a million who are seeking asylum. And so, you know, they're starting to work with lawyers. But, you know, candidly, this is a prohibitively costly, long process. And so, you know, they know that patience is a virtue, but it does add to the anxiety that they're already feeling.
Yeah. Now, it's been reported that Afghans en route to the U.S. who cannot pass the special vetting process might be sent back to Afghanistan. Is that a possibility?
It is. And we knew that that was going to be the case even in August as we were advocating for an evacuation. This is why we thought it was really important to look at places like Guam, which could have been kind of a holding location as that vetting was happening. We haven't found many examples of people who've arrived here to the U.S. just because the vetting was happening in third countries. But, you know, we are expecting that there are some individuals who have been vetted, who have been flagged, who are in third countries like Qatar, who may be sent back. But honestly, I think it's still unknown what the process will be.
Okay. That's Krish Omara Vignaraja, president of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Krish, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
The late author Robert Jordan has been described as the American Tolkien, as in J.R.R. Tolkien of Lord of the Rings. Jordan's fantasy series Wheel of Time spans a whopping 14 books. It's about a group of farmers swept up in a cosmic battle between good and evil. And now, it's a show on Amazon Prime, starting today. And Here Now's own bibliophile, Alexander Turk, tells us how Wheel of Time became a story in the first place.
Each of the 14 books in the Wheel of Time series begins with these words.
The Wheel of Time turns, and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legend fades to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth comes again.
In Robert Jordan's world, time is circular and cyclical. The dragon, humanity's messiah, is reborn again and again whenever the world needs them. The series has also been reborn into a multi-million dollar Amazon show. The Wheel of Time was originally the daydream of an engineer turned writer. His pen name was Robert Jordan, and he had just returned from Vietnam.
I met Robert Jordan because I was looking for writers, as an editor does.
Harriet McDougall is an editor and co-founder of Tor Books. She gave Jordan his first contract, and a couple of historical novels, Conan the Barbarian stories, and a marriage later, Jordan was ready.
It was after that that he revealed the Wheel of Time idea and wanted a contract. He was, of course, my husband, and I was the editor-in-chief. I couldn't give him a contract.
Tor's publisher, Tom Doherty, not only gave him a contract, but was so taken with Jordan's vision that he asked him for a six-book series. When Jordan handed McDougall the draft of the first book, The Eye of the World, he had rewritten it 27 times.
The first third was so impressive. I called Tom Doherty and said, you have to read this one. And he said, yeah, why? Anyway, I said, you have to read this one because either I have fallen into the wife trap and think his work is wonderful, or this book is absolutely wonderful. So he said, all right. And the minute he read it, he agreed.
Over the next 4 years, Jordan would weave five more books of plots and prophecies. He wrote in odd spurts, day and night, often turning to his wife for inspiration.
It wasn't just the heroines. He said that when I said, you've forgotten to take the garbage out, that I inspired some of his darkest villains of the female persuasion.
But as the sixth book approached, Jordan realized he needed more time.
Well, what he said was, it's not ending in six books, and how many will it be? I don't even remember what he answered. It was just going to be more books.
Six became 11, and the fans rejoiced, but how would this all end? Jordan always said that he knew what the very last scene would be when he wrote the very first scene. All that was left was to write it.
Like a lot of Wheel of Time fans, my emotions regarding the series just run the gamut.
That's Brandon Sanderson, the award-winning author of his own fantasy books. He remembers what it was like to be a Wheel of Time fan in the late 90s.
Anytime someone mentioned Robert Jordan's name, we would raise our fists to the air and be like, finish the books! Yet, at the same time, this was the defining book series of my youth and even my journeyman era as a writer. And so there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in there. And then he got sick.
In 2006, on the cusp of starting that last volume, Jordan announced that he had heart disease. Still, Jordan thought he could finish the series.
And he was very positive, and then he was gone.
A year later, Jordan died. He was 58. Sanderson posted a moving eulogy online that caught Harriet McDougall's eye.
I called Doherty, who was Brandon's publisher, and said, send me a book.
Sanderson flew to Charleston to meet with McDougall. She had picked Sanderson to finish her husband's great work.
Picked me up herself from the airport, took me to her house where she had a spare bedroom that I was going to stay in. And we walked in the door and she said, oh, I have some dinner that I fixed earlier. Do you want me to warm some up for you? And I said, actually, I'd like the ending, please. And she laughed and she handed it to me.
Sanderson agreed to complete the series in three books. Not one. In 2013, A Memory of Light, the 14th and final book in the Wheel of Time series, was in readers' hands.
Wheel of Time, to me, is about community and the stories that the community tells one another to reinforce and strengthen us.
Almost 50 years ago, Robert Jordan took up writing. His stories of honor and myth inspired readers like Sanderson, pushing them to write their own stories. Now it's their turn to inspire another generation.
In one age, called the Third Age by some, a wind rose in the mountains of mist. The wind was not the beginning. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the Wheel of Time. But it was a beginning.
For Here and Now, I'm Alexander Turk.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.